Hi, I am Kareem Tapsch.
And I am Joey Dowd.
And this is episode 13 of Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami. It is our bonus episode 2.
And our last episode.
And our last episode. One is thank you all for making this journey through South Florida's true crime history with us. We hope you have enjoyed it. We hope that our voices have not been too annoying.
If you're here listening to this, I guess it has not been too annoying for you, so thank you.
That's right.
If you made it to this far.
And if you think we have velvet pipes, we're really concerned about your taste level. Thanks for joining us for this crazy journey through the criminal part of our hometown, Miami, which we love dearly, warts and all. It's been a ride, hasn't it? I mean, what crazy stories?
Yeah, some wild stories. And I mean, definitely we had some famous ones a lot of people are familiar with, I was familiar with. But there were a handful here, too, where, you know, I was just digging around looking for good stories. And I wasn't familiar with a handful of these and, you know, hadn't heard of them. And they're just some wild only in Florida stories.
Yeah, I mean, this also seems like a perfect opportunity to point out what is going to be everybody's question. It's just, why didn't you talk about this? And that ultimately comes up, right? Why didn't you tell our favorite true crime story? So a couple of reasons. One of the things that we're so excited about made the podcast unique is we had the opportunity to talk to people who were either involved directly in the crimes, either as detectives or police chiefs, or were unfortunate victims of crimes, or in some cases were perpetrators, and or journalists who covered the crimes. Mm-hmm. So each episode had not just Joey and I gabbing, but also kind of a firsthand account from someone. So that was actually really, really tricky to always find somebody who wanted to go down the road of recounting these crazy experiences.
Yeah, because some of these are not the most pleasant memories to want to revisit.
Yeah, even I think from the point of journalists, I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of folks are like, yeah, this is one of the craziest things I've ever covered in my journalism career. We hope you've enjoyed listening. And if you liked it a lot and a lot of people listen, maybe there'll be more. Who knows? So one of probably the most infamous Miami crime stories that really, it's not hyperbole to say, made headlines around the world was the murder of fashion guru Gianni Versace.
Yeah, this was, I remember when the story happened when I was actually in like summer camp when this happened, and I was moving to Seacoast Tower on Collins Avenue, which coincidentally happened to be right across the street from the houseboat where Andrew Cannan killed himself, and this story ended. And I remember my mom picked me up and she was like, "You'll never believe what happened while you were gone at camp." This story just, I mean, I was too young to really know who Gianni Versace was, but this story, even revisiting it years and years later, and the miniseries that came out, and it just sort of has always been in 20, 25 years later, is this still in kind of pop culture limelight?
Yeah. I mean, also, you're no fashionista to know Versace.
I'm not. Not like you, Kareem.
That's right. Not like me. The sad part is, like, those like Medusa silk shirts that Versace became so famous for, they never made them in my size, by the way. One, and two, have always been too poor to afford them. So if anybody has two or three that they could sew together for me, we will send you an address, and maybe I could finally slip into one. It really is kind of a crazy story. And genuinely only in Miami, because it happened right here. The city really took over the city when it happened. And you have a really kind of, one of the things that we didn't talk about the episode is you have a real kind of personal connection to the story, not just because you grew up on Miami Beach or your mom was a former police officer. She worked at the Miami Beach Police Department when this happened. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So I do have another connection besides my mom and I moving in across the street to the houseboat where this all ended. My mom did work at the police department. She was a cop for a few months, and then she worked as an administrator inside the police department. And I chatted with her about a crazy story that happened to her with the Versace murder and with his autopsy photos that took place after.
So after his autopsy, my major, Steve Robbins, came to me and he said, I have Versace's autopsy pictures and I need to keep them in a safe place and with a reliable person. And will you lock them up somewhere and keep them safe? And so I took them. I never looked at them. I locked it away. Because, you know, I can't speak for Steve, but there are a lot of people lacking integrity who were working there, and they certainly didn't want anything leaking, especially somebody's autopsy photos. So I locked them away, and then after work, I had mentioned it to my father, and my father said to me, you give those pictures back. You shouldn't be responsible for anything because there might be other copies around, and if somebody releases them, people might think it's you. You need to just not be responsible for that. So the next day I did. I turned them back to Steve. And I am pleased to say that nobody ever, to my knowledge, ever released any of his autopsy photos.
As far as I know, Versace's autopsy photos, as it should be, have never been made public.
I mean, to her credit, she's a stand-up
person. She is a stand-up. And that was probably why they gave it to her in the first place. Because she would keep it safe.
Joey, on the other hand, would have sold it for the first person to offer him $5.
Yep, exactly.
Exactly right.
At one point, my mom also did work in the chief's office, and she did work for Chief Richard Barreto, who we interviewed for this story. And during some Take Your Kids to Work days, I actually have a photo of me with Richard Barreto. I was very young, and a pic of me standing next to him. But talking to him, one thing that kind of came to my mind was I was curious. You see these police officials on TV when crazy stories happen, and suddenly an administrator or some city official is now thrust into the limelight on the international stage. And so I was curious kind of what, you know, goes through your mind when you're in that position and that happens to you. So we have this tape from Richard Barreto.
Yeah, I'm curious more on, from your end, because I remember, with the press conferences and stuff, you definitely became that part of the face of the investigation. You know, what goes through your mind when, you're chief of a relatively small city and then, you're on the international stage and you have to give updates that the whole world's watching?
I didn't look at it like that. I actually, they always say you revert back to your training. And I was lucky because, prior to that, I had been sent to the FBI National Academy, which is the Harvard of police schools. And one of the classes that I took was media relations. And they taught me how to do press conferences and stuff. So I was able to revert back to that training, and it came very much handy for me to have that knowledge, because I had learned for a formal press conference, you write everything down. Word for word that you're going to articulate, as opposed to going out there and just winging it, off the hip.
And I mean, the whole world was watching and listening because Gianni Versace was a global figure. I think I talk about this a little bit in the episode. I was about 17 when Versace was assassinated, and I remember going down to South Beach. And I do remember just the slew of news camera, news trucks everywhere. It's just like, first of all, media wanted to talk to anyone and everyone. They were just like getting, man on the streets, but they also wanted people connected somehow. So the whole world wanted to know what happened because Versace was a huge global figure who changed not just fashion, but through fashion really kind of influenced like pop culture around the world.
And it wasn't like the story ended when he died. You had this manhunt playing out of like, where is Andrew Cunanan, and all of the crazy theories that he smuggled on a ship and he was going to Haiti, or, you know, that college kid that got pulled over and someone assumed he was Cunanan because he had a hat on. And so, yeah, the story's playing out in real time because it didn't end for about another week.
Yeah. It was kind of like primetime news. I mean, I always think, you know, that's such a good case when you think back of like the 24-hour news cycle. Mm-hmm. It was one of those things, like I remember the OJ case, both the trial and the chase was on television nonstop. And I remember Versace was on TV nonstop at the time. It just kind of like captured everything. It captured the world's attention all at once. And it has had a lasting impact and impression on Miami Beach. I mean, first of all, the Versace Mansion. If you are from Miami Beach, or if you've ever visited, one thing will stick out, which is how weird it is that there's this ginormous mansion on Ocean Drive in the midst of like hotels and bars, right?
Yeah, it's such a... I mean, it's such an amazing spot if you have the resources to have a huge mansion somewhere, but it's also such a weird spot. It's, you know, Ocean Drive, this is when you see those aerials flying into South Beach, or just any like Miami establishing shot in a movie is like the Art Deco strip of mostly hotels. And then you have Versace, who had this private Spanish-influenced...
Mediterranean influenced
mansion, private residence right on Ocean Drive, literally across the street from the beach. But to have a private residence there is just very weird. Like, there's a lot of big, huge mansions in Miami Beach, but they're usually on Star Island or some other exclusive kind of gated island. And they're gated. They have security. They're protected to some extent. Versace, like, he walks out of his gate where he was ultimately gunned down. You know, that's public sidewalk. And part of the reason why, you know, it's easy for Cunanan to just walk right up to him and kill him. But he didn't think that would ever happen to him.
Yeah. And I mean, I think also at the time, like while Miami Beach had changed greatly, in large part due to his influence and like the global celebrities who kind of followed and came to like play in Miami Beach in the area, he was like a local who just walked around mm-hmm. everywhere.
I feel like going to your point with what you're saying about like the changing image of Miami Beach, and he lived like right in the heart of where those images came out, where you have the images of it's Christy Turlington and all the models roller skating down South Beach. That's in Loomis Park, which is right across the street from where his mansion was. You have the not the Clevelander, the photo shoot, one of the early photo shoots that they did on top of the Art Deco buildings with the photographer who got me to recently.
I mean, there was all of those kind of, you're thinking of like all the iconic images that folks like Bruce Weber took on South Beach of like, you know, world famous models. I mean,
Where they put South Beach on the map as like, oh, destination to have your photo shoots, your model shoots and all that. And Versace's mansion was like right smack in the middle of it.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this in the episode. I don't remember if you can see it, but... I mean, I love the architecture of South Beach, and the Art Deco is so stunning. Ocean Drive is often used as the best example of it. But if you ever want to see like one of the most beautiful images of South Beach and also watch a great movie at the same time, watch The Birdcage with Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. The opening shot of South Beach, where it comes from the Atlantic, you know, slowly kind of coming into the beach, and you see it at night lit up in neon. It's really, really stunning. And then you think among all that neon and reverie, there's like a private home. It's kind of bonkers. And it's still there. It's lived on. It's become a private club and a hotel. We talked a little bit about that in the last episode. What it has also remained is a really weird, morbid tourist spot. People take pictures in front of it, sometimes laying on the steps where Versace was found, which is really kind of...
It's a creepy form of tourism.
Gross and callous, but also I get it, kind of. I don't know. It's weird. And Versace's kind of... This is a story that has remained in pop culture, which brings me to a point of great argument between my dear Joey Dad and myself, and that is... American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, the miniseries. of which Joey is a fan and of which I am not.
I think it is a solid series that thoroughly covered the story and was very entertaining and informative.
I think that there are a lot of big name actors and pop stars who could not act their way out of a paper bag. And this is unfortunately highlighted. So I actually could not get through the first episode beginning to end without stopping it a few times. And I think I actually watched maybe like three episodes and I said, there's no way I'm sitting through this garbage anymore. It was so over the top acted. And I don't know. It was bad. It was bad. I don't know how you watch this.
I don't know how you found it bad. I found it entertaining. I also appreciate any show that actually does shoot in Miami. And I mean, they did shoot in Miami Beach. They shot in the mansion. There was a shot, and I mean, I live in Santa Monica right now, and there was, and Santa Monica has a lot of Art Deco buildings, and I did realize, I'm like, hey, you cheated that, and you shot that in Santa Monica. That was not in South Beach.
I mean, I will say that, you know, Ricky Martin in a Speedo is certainly a reason to watch, but as it turns out, the internet has a Google image search, and so I could just skip actually watching an entire episode to see that. And that is maybe the only great thing about that. And
Kareem gives it 5 Ricky Martins.
I give like 1 Ricky Martin is more Ricky Martin than anyone actually needs. And more than I mean, it's more than you. let's be honest. But I will say there is a lot of historical accuracy in the show, at least the ones that I saw and in other episodes. And it definitely does capture a lot of Miami. And part of that is thanks to Ryan Murphy, who produced the series. I can't remember. Did he direct as well?
I actually don't know about that, if he directed it. He definitely produced it.
Yeah, he definitely produced it. And fun fact, Ryan Murphy, before he was like the TV streaming content god that he is now, was a writer and reporter at the Miami Herald.
I did not realize that. Yeah. That's fascinating.
And this is not the only Miami story he has told. If you recall, I think his first real big hit was Nip Tuck, which was also set in Miami.
That is a Miami show I never saw.
Wow. And you say you're from here. That's right. Yeah. Bad Boys and Nip Tuck. It's,
you know, if we're on the subject of Miami media, I will defend Fast and Furious 2, Too Fast, Too Furious, all the way to the end as being a solid Fast and Furious film, but also the most accurate portrayal of Miami geography that I've ever seen on screen.
Okay. That's fair. That's fair. We'll give credit where credit is due for all those of us, all 8 of us who care about accurate portrayal of Miami geography. It stands up. Listen, I am not a video gamer, but I will also say that Vice City is a fun look at Miami. Every time I see somebody playing
pretty
it, I'm
accurate,
like,
too.
It's also pretty accurate.
All of their games are pretty accurate. When I moved to LA, I had a pretty good understanding of geography thanks to GTA 5.
Which, you know, it brings us to, if you want to hear more about this story, there's a million places to go. Joy would tell you to watch the true crime, American Crime Story series. I would tell you to not, but it has been told and retold a million times. And in the episode, we talk a little bit about the film that Joey and I made that kind of like predates this era. So, which is The Last Resort. It kind of tells you how South Beach went from like a sleepy town of retirees in the 70s to a global destination. So, shameless plug, check out The Last Resort.
Yeah, just a decade earlier before Versace was there, it was elderly Jews just chilling in their lawn chairs in the park right across the street from where he would build his mansion.
Yeah, and just a few decades after Gianni Versace was murdered. While it physically looks the same, it is a completely different city. Miami Beach and South Beach in particular really feels like it kind of reinvents itself every 20 years to something vastly different than what it was before. So more importantly than watching all this stuff, come visit Miami and Miami Beach. By the way, those are 2 separate places.
They are 2 separate places. Yeah, that is another point of contention of every time they show an establishing shot of Miami and then they show South Beach and Ocean Drive as the establishing shot of Miami, and it's like, that's not Miami, that's Miami Beach.
And is it Pitbull's famous Miami's not Miami Beach line? I'm not hip, I don't know, but I know that there's a popular.
While we're on the subject, Kendall is not the hood. A-Rod, okay.
Thanks, A-Rod. And actually, thanks to former police chief Richard Barreto for sharing his stories and for his years of service.
So the next episode we're going to revisit is Supermarket Slayer.
Manuel Marin.
Thank you.
You hesitated.
I was gonna anglicize it.
Oh, okay. Why don't you try it?
Manuel Marin.
Yep. That's
Manuel Marin.
100% the way you say it.
So this was the brutal murder in the Everglades where Manuel Marin killed his wife's lover.
Correct. This is a lot, this episode, right? Because one is just kind of like the horrific nature of the way Camilo Salazar
was brutally murdered. It's got that. It's got a little bit of the Everglades, which is Florida swampland, but I always try to put in my Everglades defense of that it's not actually a swamp. It is its own unique ecosystem. Swamp is still water, and the Everglades, technically the water is moving all the way south, and so it has its own unique ecosystem. So it's not swampland, even though everyone calls it swampland.
I learn something new every time I'm with you.
You get a little bit of murder, a little bit of ecological education.
That's a date with Joey. If he wasn't already married, this is what everybody you're missing out on. Lucky Becca. But when we were looking at cases, we really actually wanted to talk about the Everglades because it's such a unique part of our community, and it's such a vital part of the ecosystem to not just South Florida but Florida as a whole. Also, it is just the site of where a lot of awful things have happened.
Yeah, this is our backwoods. This is the South Florida's wilderness. So this is where you're going to, something's going to happen that no one wants to know is happening. This is the spot they're going to take you or try to get rid of you.
Yeah, because of how remote it is, but also because of the wildlife, there are gators, there are panthers, there are things that could theoretically eat you or eat remains and thus evidence that disappear. I guess I don't know how often that part actually happens because maybe the evidence does disappear. Like, there's probably a lot of like gator fodder that's been left out in the Everglades. However, like one of the sad things, but just one of the realities is like the Everglades is like right on the border of civilization. It used to be like when we were kids, you had to really like schlep out to go to the Everglades, and you were like basically, the last house and or shopping mall ended and you drove for miles and miles and miles before you kind of got to the Everglades. And we've really kind of, it's just because of overpopulation and overdevelopment, which is such a huge issue in our community, we've really built up right to the edge of the Everglades. And so it doesn't feel as, in some ways, doesn't kind of feel as remote as it used to.
No, because you have a lot of neighborhoods that are just right on the border of Chrome Avenue, where that's pretty much literally the line of civilization. Like if you fly into Miami and you just look out the window, you can see this very clear line of houses and developments and buildings, and then a huge line that's a street, and then nothing but wilderness. Of the wilderness used here is sawgrass and mangroves and trees and stuff, not big trees or mountains or anything.
Yeah, and with it being so important, it's also it makes it kind of all the more horrific that this beautiful place of like birth and rebirth also is the site of horrible crimes like the murder of Camilo Salazar, which is in some ways it's the ultimate revenge murder. It's a crime of passion, and it was one that was premeditated quite a bit and inspired by Jenny Marine's loneliness and solitude in her marriage. And so let's hear from journalist David Ovalle as he tells us a little bit about that.
So Manuel had been married previously, and when he divorced, he actually caught up with Jenny and sort of just swept her off her feet, right? I remember writing about their marriage and how it was sort of this, on the surface, there's just like this perfect marriage because they've lived in, you know, this beautiful house, and they had a nanny, and they had, you know, luxury boats, and the kids went to private school, and you know, but behind, you know, behind the facade, Jenny was, you know, felt very isolated, she felt very cold, she didn't quite, there was, you know, I mean, he was Cuban, she was Colombian, he was a little bit older, so there was a little bit of a culture clash there because, you know, he, I mean, even something as silly as he would use slang that she didn't quite understand, right, even though they were both Spanish speakers, right? So it was just little things like that, and then just, you know, he worked a lot, he, you know, had his interests, and he was just, he didn't really have friends. He was kind of like this machista, you know, Cuban guy, and very controlling, and she just felt very alone. So it was not the marriage that it was cracked up to be on paper.
Where does this case rank in Miami stories for you that you've covered?
Oh, it's like top three. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most Miami cases, and I think it because you have the MMA connection, you have the president, the supermarkets connection, which, like unless you live in South Florida, you're not going to know what president of the supermarkets are. You know what I mean? So it's like so super Miami, you know, and like the son, you know, running these sort of businesses. Like he was a part investor in like one of these really famous kebab places here. It's like very, you know, sort of hip and trendy and cool, and so. You know, yeah, there's so many layers of Miami. And then, of course, you know, love triangle and, you know, long quest for justice. And, you know, there's so many sort of subplots that sort of make this a really enticing case to cover.
I think one of my favorite lines from the article, I don't know if it was when they asked Jenny, I guess where she went after the boat or something. And she said, I went to Publix. And they're like, not Presidente. Just like, no.
yeah, that was the prosecutor, Gail Levine, who couldn't resist it. And you know, it was funny, and you know, those are, that's one of the things that made Gail Levine a great prosecutor was, you know, she had the perfect timing with those kinds of little things that the jurors loved, you know, and so everyone sort of cracks up laughing. But there's just so many different little inherent tensions like that throughout the trial that was fascinating.
Yeah,
that part, we touched a bit about this in the last bonus episode of when people think of South Florida and they're like, oh, it's very Hispanic, and they group just all of the different cultures and countries and where everyone came from as just Hispanic. But there are a lot of differences and nuances in all the differences of where everyone came from or where their heritage is from. I definitely cannot speak a lot about that, but you definitely know more about sort of the nuances, and especially what David is alluding to in sort of the rifts of their marriage, of having these two different cultures.
Yeah, as the resident Latino of the two of us here, it definitely rings true. I mean, this was in many ways kind of like they were a little bit of an unlikely pairing, right? First of all, because there's about a 20-year age difference between Jenny and Manuel. He was married when they met. She wanted nothing to do with him, and then he got divorced, and she had lived in South Florida, but she was actually Colombian, but raised or had lived in Jersey area, and he was more from South Florida. So there's those kind of cultural differences. But, you know, also there was just this kind of like the differing, you know, I like to call it the differing flavors of Latino. We do get painted in with broad strokes of being the same. So aside from like being 20 years apart and from having grown up in different parts of the country or lived in the part of the country, they were different culturally as well, right? Like Manuel Marin was Cuban and Jenny was Colombian. And there is very distinct differences between our cultures and like the history that we know. And you know, Miami has a sizable, obviously well-known, sizable, huge Cuban community. It has also a very large Colombian community, and these days a large Venezuelan community. And little things like variations on food, right, that you grow up with, right? But also just like slang. One of my favorite examples of this is the word bicho. So I am half Cuban, half Lebanese. And in Cuban slang, bicho generally means a bug, right? La casa tiene bichos means that there are bugs in the house. If you are Puerto Rican, another island in the Caribbean, bicho is slang for penis. So you can imagine when you use words that mean one thing it's for you in the same language.
House infestation.
I'm going to leave that. Yes. I have not lived in that house.
Five Ricky Martins.
Nice. Thank you for the callback. It is interesting because if you think about it, it seems like a small, innocuous thing. Like, it's the same language, but slang means different things. Mm-hmm. Imagine living in a place where you are with someone who is working all the time, 20 years older than you. You don't have a great deal of friends. And, like, you make a passing reference or use a word, and you don't completely understand what it's like. I mean, you know, I feel like I could empathize with Jenny Marin's plight in that, you know, she felt alone, and she was kind of looking for some solace, and she found it in Camilo Salazar.
At the Galleria Mall.
At the Galleria Mall and a nearby hotel. One of the other things I love about this recollection from David Ovalle of the Miami Herald is the line from Gail Levine, the prosecutor in the case. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a great court exchange where they get back from the boat and she's asking Jenny, what'd you do after the boat? She says, I went to Publix. Not Presidente? No. Which is such a great line, but also such a only, like, you only get the subtlety of that if you're really from Miami. Both Presidente supermarkets mostly, but also Publix is, it's not just a Miami thing, that's a southern United States staple. I mean, they've expanded a bit, but they started in Lakeland, Florida, and they're just the main food store in all of South Florida. And for her to say she went to Publix, which is a South Florida staple, and not her husband's food store, is a nice little jab at him in the courtroom.
I mean, the problems clearly started from before. Publix versus Presidente argument in the Marin home must have been an interesting one. This was a wild story. As we say, Manuel Marin was extradited from Spain and is awaiting trial, as with so many things and so many of the cases that we talk about in this season.
They're supposed to go to trial, but it got delayed due to the pandemic.
Thanks, COVID. I'm sure we're going to hear more about this case soon. That's all we have for the supermarket slayer, Manuel Marin.
I swear, every time I hear supermarket slayer, I think of supermarket sweep.
Yeah, this one's a very different show that ends with a murder. Murderitaville, Tara Rosado and Carlos Ortiz. This is maybe our only case in the Florida Keys.
I wanted a Keys story. I wanted an Everglades story. I'm glad we got them both.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, the Florida Keys are such a distinct place, right? It's like you think mm-hmm. beach bum vibe, laid back kind of island life. That's the Keys.
I mean, thanks in part to Jimmy Buffett.
Yeah, I mean, huge thanks.
Exporting his music and creating this huge image. And, I mean, basically Disneyfying the Keys with Margaritaville and his restaurants and hotels that he's built around it.
Yeah, he has, full disclosure, I'm a big Jimmy Buffett fan. And I'm only 42, not 68. But
68 at heart.
68 at heart, that's right. And in my legs. But Jimmy Buffett has this, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. One of his famous songs and, like, vibes, right? It's like, you should just be chilling and having a beer. It's already 5 o'clock. So that's kind of the vibe that the Keys has really always had, but in a way been amplified thanks to the permission of that reputation. And there's a seedy underbelly. This story really covers it. And this story is just really, really more and more complicated as it goes on. So one of the things, maybe you could set this up for us, this clip that we're about to hear.
Yeah, so in the episode we covered that, yes, there was one jailhouse confession that kind of threw a bit of doubt into who actually, you know, if Jeremy McCauley was the trigger man who killed Tara and Carlos. In that jailhouse confession that we covered in the episode, it was like, oh no, it was both of the Demblance brothers were the ones that killed them. But then there was another jailhouse confession, and this one didn't really play out as much into the case, so we didn't have it in the episode, but it's still both kind of like bizarre, where it's like, wait, this case involved like two jailhouse confessions of two other people who shared cells with people that were involved in the case, that they heard confessions about stuff that happened in the case, and then they went to police and they had no reason to go to the police. Anyways, this is another story from another jailhouse confession that we're going to play this clip for you right now. So the interesting thing about Jeremy Vest's story is, unlike Eric Lansford's story, where he sort of said he had like this moral obligation to go to the police, like even though he's about to be released, he didn't have any deal to strike to get a, you know, time shaved off his sentence for telling the police what he heard. But he was just like, oh, he said he didn't kill the kids, and that's just like morally awful, and like I just had to tell someone about that. But with Jeremy Vest, it was sort of like there really wasn't any moral outrage on his part, from what it seemed from hearing what he had to say. And it also just kind of seemed, it didn't seem like his version of events really went anywhere, except for saying, oh no, they weren't on Rick Rodriguez's boat. They were on the Real G, which was their boat. And David said he did track down that they did own that boat. And he was one of the first people that kind of uncovered that the Real G was Macaulay's boat. But that, that Rick Rodriguez had nothing to do with it, which Rick Rodriguez was a very interesting aspect of the story, because everyone kind of seemed to believe that, yes, he was on the boat when they found the drugs. And like, how could you be the captain of a boat and not know that someone found 33 pounds of cocaine floating in the ocean? But he was never charged with anything, and he was never charged. Nothing never happened to him.
Yeah, it certainly raises a lot of questions and doubt. But the criminal justice system played out the way it is, and Rick Rodriguez has never been charged and is a free man.
I mean, as David said, I mean, they didn't, all the drugs were sold, and there was no evidence to say otherwise that he couldn't prove that he knew about it. So,
yeah, yeah. Wild story. Thanks again to David Ovalle for talking to us for that episode, Murderitaville, Dara Rosado, and Carlos Ortiz. So, Cruising to Nowhere, Gus Bulis. This is a story of a really kind of popular local businessman who created these empires that were beloved locally. We waxed.
Two empires.
We waxed poetically about the deliciousness of what was Miami Subs.
And their delicious curly fries.
Thank you, my waistline. Thanks you, Mr. Bulis. And Sun Cruz Casino, basically the thing that really kind of eventually led to his death, which were these cruise ships at sea.
Cruise ships to nowhere. Yeah. I never went on one, but the commercials of the Sun Cruise definitely live on in my head from childhood, from hearing them nonstop all the time.
I did go on one once. I think I told you this in the episode. And I also went on, there was a slew of these cruise ships at the time. I went on one for my 15th birthday, which was the Discovery or the Sea Escape, Sea Escape takes you on a day cruise. But interestingly, gambling in South Florida has only grown since then. South Florida is obviously native lands, like most of the United States are, and so there are the Seminoles and Miccosukee, and historically the Tequestas here. And so the Seminole tribe of Native Americans owns the Hard Rock Casino, which is a massive guitar-shaped building.
The guitar is new. But that is also more of like a monument to how successful they have been in bringing gambling to South Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
And through just, I mean, I don't have the full like step-by-step play of what they did. But at the time Sun Cruise was around, they were mostly like bingo was sort of the legal form of gambling that you were allowed to do on the Seminole lands. And it's slowly evolved to, they had slot machines. I remember seeing slot machines that were somehow based on bingo, and it was sort of this like loophole where you could, oh yeah, it's a slot machine, but it's somehow based on bingo, and that's how they were able to get away with it. And then it's evolved now where, I mean, they have full-blown table games. Like, it's basically like you're in a Vegas casino, and this is through an evolution of the laws. And I feel like part of the reason Sun Cruise was appealing to was that was the only way you can kind of gamble if you wanted to get that Vegas experience in. And now it's easier to do that in South Florida.
Yeah, and I mean, aside from just the hard rock that we've been describing, you know, Gus Boulos was onto something with these kind of cruises to nowhere. It's just one of the very successful and highly announced businesses that kind of rolled into town was a Resort Worlds casino, which was a more luxury cruise liner, which did, again, cruises to nowhere or to the Bahamas, and you could gamble on board. And that's...
Yeah, their ferry system, I guess, was a little bit more trying to be double use of, it would be the ferry to Bimini, or they'd also run ferries that were just ferries to nowhere and basically doing the exact same thing as Sun Cruise of go out, party, come back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is kind of, gambling has always been a thing and it's had an appeal, but with it comes, as we learned, in what is ultimately a cautionary tale, with it comes a lot of attention and a lot of, competition and greed.
And NIMBYs and people that don't want gambling in their area. I will say the one thing that never made sense about the whole plan of like trying to force Gus Boulos to sell his cruise ships was, okay, he sells them, they're not going to disappear. So that part of the government's sort of plan of like trying to get this, you know, sticking it to him and making him sell his boats, what was the next play? I never really understood what they're like. Why would they force him to sell? And they weren't going to disappear.
Yeah, yeah. It is a question that came up in my mind too, and I think in some of our listeners as well. And another thing that this case, you know, had was we talked about the organized crime and the connection to the Gambino crime family and John Gotti and some of the kind of, you know, organized crime figures that were involved in Gus Boulos' murder, which was ultimately a mob hit. I think it's kind of worth pointing out that organized crime in South Florida and like kind of traditional mafia, as we think of it, is nothing new here, right?
It's been around since Al Capone.
Yeah.
I was thinking it's probably been around before him.
Trying to think of
bootlegger days and... I mean, also, even probably Prohibition days, thanks to, like, all the coastal land, it's been a great smuggling spot back when you had to smuggle in alcohol.
Yeah. I mean, Al Capone famously lived in Miami Beach, even though he was obviously most notorious for being a Chicago gangster. He died in Miami Beach. He, quote-unquote, retired in Miami Beach, which in reality meant he built a summer home here that is... it still exists, by the way. It's on Palm and Hibiscus Island. And it had, like, secret corridors to it. And he was 100% running his crime empire still at that point.
Sounds like how Griselda retired to California and then retired in prison and was still running her drug empire.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, the leopard never changes his spots. And, you know, even after Capone, obviously, like, you know, a few decades later, Meyer Lansky, the famous mobster Meyer Lansky, retired to Miami Beach and lived kind of in plain sight. So there has always been a criminal underbelly to Miami, and there's always been kind of an organized crime element present here. And Gus Boulos, unfortunately, was just one of the victims of that. Cruising to Nowhere, Gus Boulos. We hope you enjoyed that episode. We hope you enjoyed listening to Paradise Lost, Crime of Miami, bonus episode 2. This is it.
Yeah, we hope you enjoyed the whole series.
Yeah, it's been great spending some time with y'all every week. We hope that you have enjoyed the stories. Thank you for taking down this trip down criminally pathway in Miami's history.
Criminal memory lane.
Criminal memory lane.
South Florida.
Nobody else I would rather go down this road with than you, Joy.
Likewise, Kareem. It's been a fun journey with you.
And we hope you guys have enjoyed it. Please, if you like, you find us on social media. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Kareem Tabsch, KAREEMTABSCH.
And I am at C47. Let us know what your favorite episode was and your favorite story.
Yeah, and feel free to comment on your favorite podcast platform and encourage folks to listen. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
And make sure to comment and rate on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you for listening to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami, where each new episode will bring you a true crime story right from the South Florida headlines.
Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami is a production of Sonoro and Trojan Horse in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura Network. Hosted and produced by Kareem Tapsch, Joey Dowd, and Christian Hatar.
Edited by Angelina Mosher Salazar. Fact-checking by Evelyn Uribe and Sara Mota. Engineering by Mane Parra, Daniel Padilla, and Fernando Galaviz. Executive produced by Jasmine Romero and Joshua Weinstein for Sonoro, Kareem Tapsch and Alex Fumero for Trojan Horse, and Giselle Bansis and Conal Byrne for iHeart. Listen to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.